Swish, swish, bish. Another one in the basket.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your 96-hour live stream to confront your wokeness failures. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Your game is tired. You should retire. You're bad as cute as an old coupon expired. And karma's not a liar. She keeps receipts. So keep calm, honey. I'ma stick around for more than a minute. Get used to it. Funny, my name keeps coming at your mouth.
Swish, swish. No, it's not Kanye. It's Katy Perry. Katy Perry's back here with your girl Nicki Minaj on the nth single from her new album, Witness, which was released last week. Katy Perry, for those of you who don't know, is America's greatest female pop star. Yeah, no, that's not true. But Katy Perry is super famous. And I am joined today not just to talk about Katy, but also to talk about new album from Lorde, the last album from Halsey, what exactly is happening in sort of post-Gleam female pop. I am joined today by New York Times pop music editor Karen Gans.
Hi, John.
New York Times pop music reporter Joe Coscarelli.
Bon appetit. Is that appropriate that, usage?
That's better. Why did I think
I don't know.
Of that?
I'm going to run that past standards. Yeah. And to my right, a cardboard cutout of Taylor Swift, who will be here to discuss her Spotify release later.
This is really weird.
This is not
true.
A metaphor.
Yes. No. This is not. No. Everything here is true. There are no metaphors on Popcast.
Startled by the presence of a giant cardboard Taylor Swift in a chair here.
Taylor, we'll get to you. Stop talking. We'll get to you, I promise. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Witness as an album first, and then Karen, we're going to hopefully dive deep into your time with Katy Perry. Witness is not as bad as I thought it would be. The singles were troubling, I thought. The singles were inconsistent. They suggested a lack of cohesive direction. Katy is a person who is sort of hopscotched between styles over her albums, and this seemed like it was not just going to hopscotch from the last album to this one, but also within the album, there was going to be a bunch of hopscotching. I will say I was really impressed with the production on this record. It feels very modern. It doesn't feel overbearing. I struggle more with the words and how they were said.
Sometimes it sounds like she's struggling with the words, to be honest.
Not just the words, but also how they were said.
Yes. True. So Witness, what's our takes on Witness?
Karen, you spent the most time with this album.
I spent a lot of time with Witness.
You did.
And I'm going to be honest, like I don't want to say I love it. I like it. Mm-hmm. I think that if you just read about it on the internet, you would think that it was like a giant calamity. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're looking at a giant calamity, I will point you in the direction of Joanne.
Oh! This
is all right, so Gaga gets the first shot.
Flex bombs. Yeah. Where's my flex bomb?
We need an air horn.
Boom, boom, boom. Pedro, we're going to come up with a podcast version of a flex bomb.
Because I think there's similarities between these albums. And also, I was like sort of surprised to learn that Gaga and Katy had become pretty good friends. She told me that like they talk regularly since election night when they were hanging out.
Yes, a scene which you rendered in vivid color in your profile of Katy
Perry. As vividly as one can render.
Yes.
But I think they're both authenticity grabs. Except the way that Lady Gaga did that was she thought that she had to marry authenticity to like a quote unquote authentic sound. She had to strip it down, had to be acoustic,
right.
Had to be, you know, like rootsy.
She had to take the costumes off.
Yes. And I don't think that that's what Katy did. I think Katy just sort of shifted a little bit.
New costume.
Yeah.
Less hair. New costume.
And there's, if you watch any of the 96 hours, because I watched a lot of it, there were many different explanations for the hair.
Joe, Witness, it feels like an interesting gesture from a singer who I think has not spent a lot of time preoccupied with the relationship between her inner self and her outer self. And then here you have an album that is sort of premised upon a reckoning. I'm not sure it's a successful reckoning, but it's at least premised on a reckoning. And I think what Karen, what you said is right, which is that it does actually have some kin with the Gaga record in that way. But the transformation isn't as severe, and also the reckoning is not as, I don't want to say Gaga's was successful, but at least it was thorough.
True. To paraphrase Katy herself, I'll say, I miss Teenage Dream more than I loved you.
Oh.
I think is sort of where I sit on this, which is like, but I get the struggle that you're talking about, which is, I think when you've been a cog in the pop machine for so long, it's hard then to be like, no, no, this is the real me to come out when, you know, I think if she had, you know, she had her time when she was like a Christian singer with an acoustic guitar or whatever, but she didn't have sort of three or even one album where she was sort of building from a grassroots place. Like she, Katy Perry came pretty fully formed. She came fresh out of the box as this, you know, cyber pop Barbie with, you know, the different cone bras and whipped cream bras and spinning right. pinwheel and bras. Right. And, you know, she was a product.
Talk about supercuts. Jeez.
She was a product before she was a person in our eyes, I think. Mm-hmm. So for her
without an inner battle. That's also the thing. I will say a thing that Katy does have in common with, say, the pop stars that Karen, you and I grew up on, Madonna. It's like you never sense that Katy Perry internally was screaming, no, I don't want to be this pop icon, but they're making me. You don't get the sense. Like, she was just like, oh, word?
And partly because she's so good at it.
Yeah, like,
she's
ridiculously good at it.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I will do that. If that's what it takes, if that's what the consensus says it takes, no problem.
And I think if there's anything you get from the documentary part of me, it's that she is a professional. Like, she, you know, you see her, as Karen and I have discussed many times, crying and then getting lifted onto the stage and just, like, being on. You know, she's just so good at being on.
To be fair, I was weeping openly 30 seconds before we started. It's not just Katy.
And here you are.
Here we are, just shining. Okay, so Karen, you spent a lot of time with Katy.
I spent a lot of time near Katy.
In her orbit.
Yeah.
Right, in her gravitational pull. Yes. Sure. Yeah. Okay, so listeners can go and seek out the article. There's a lot of gem detail in there.
Please
Let's
do.
Talk about what's not in there. When you are in Miss Perry's orbit, what is that moving thing like? What's the energy like? What's the dynamic? Who's really in power? What's the kind of give and take?
A lot of questions there,
That's
John.
What I have.
A lot to unpack. I think that she really is in charge. I think she's in charge of her empire in a pretty intense way. I think she is a businesswoman in addition to being an artist, and that's something we discussed a little bit. She travels with a crew of people that seem to be very friendly with her. I was surprised I didn't see more of them on the live stream, which made it less like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and more like an actual commercial, which is something I wasn't really expecting when I started to watch it.
Seemed more like prison to me.
Yeah. She put herself, I mean, she did this to herself. This was her idea. And she told one of her friends on the what was called Witness Worldwide, that she had initially come up with the idea at Burning Man, which led me to be worried.
For the uninitiated, the idea being
the
that she would
live
stream herself on YouTube for, what was it,
it was
96
hours
straight of just her in a house with her adorable dog Nugget.
We do love Nugget. Nugget's
and also like
show.
A series of kind of like in like wokeness encounters.
Right.
Yeah.
Like one with DeRay talking about cultural appropriation, one with the guy who is the therapist on Viceland. There were more, I think.
Well, this is another
RuPaul
part of like
showed up.
Yeah, RuPaul showed up. Jeremy Scott was there.
Jeremy Scott was there just hanging.
He was just there though.
Yeah.
Were these people paid?
Can I really think that this was like, you know,
you think
they wanted to be a part of this.
You think DeRay didn't get a check for that?
I really don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
They just got him a fresh vest.
Yeah. We're going to report this out.
But I will say, I mean, like, listening to Katy speak on the live stream and listening to her speak to me and watching her interact with people, like, the language of therapy and personal evolution is very thick with her right now. Like, this is really where she is, which is why I don't think that this is a guise, and I don't think that this was, like, something she decided to do to market herself. I think it's the other way around. I think that it's being used to market the album. But I think that she very genuinely did undergo an epiphany of sorts, and she wants to change.
So talk to us about the wokeness, because that's something that she attributed to, I guess, election night in your interview.
Well, she said she's been undergoing a few awakenings, but that one was like definitely happened on election night when she found herself, you know, like many people, just expecting that Hillary was going to win. And then the realization that she wasn't, it wasn't just a realization about defeat, but it was a realization about sexism in America and hopefulness and like where we are and what work we have to do. And then she was sort of triggered about like a sexual inequality in her own past. And she didn't really elaborate on that, just to say that, you know, in her family, and there were issues with her father growing up where she wasn't necessarily, or women weren't necessarily seen as equal.
And there's a line on the album about how much she loves her mom, but how she wants to be able to sit down at the dinner table first,
yes.
Which I thought was pretty evocative compared to a lot of the other lyrics on
which are
this
sort of like platitudinous.
Right, or just horrible metaphors and similes. Mm-hmm. But I think the main misunderstanding going into Witnesses, and the election night thing sort of ties into this, but this idea that this was going to be her sort of statement album about politics. She was a big surrogate for Hillary, and she was using this term purposeful pop for a while when Chain to the Rhythm came out. And I think people were expecting this to be a political statement album, but Karen, as you've pointed out repeatedly, it's more of a personal statement album, and she sort of took what was going on in the world
and tried to apply it to
applied
herself.
It all through herself and through like this idea of therapy and her family and her wanting to be a different kind of strong woman on this album than especially the previous two.
We should listen to Chain to the Rhythm, which was the first single and is one of several songs on this record that I really, really like the instrumental to. Here's Chain to the Rhythm.
The subtweet.
Okay, so that was Chain to the Rhythm, which was the first Katy Perry single off Witness, and was a song that she performed it with Skip Marley at the Grammys.
Wearing a white pantsuit with an armband that said Persist.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, just a lot of meat, like, you know, just like a walking political meme kind of. Again, and Joe, as you were saying, this is a song that was, I don't want to say a bait and switch, but it was presented as Katy Perry's now alive to the possibilities of the political realities and the social and cultural realities of this country. I mean, last year she was tweeting about misogynoir. You know, I'm sure she has a woke coach. I don't know who the woke coach is, but I'm sure she has a woke coach. But then it turned out that what actually is happening on this record is not so macro. It's more micro.
It's a little more man in the mirror, to be honest. She's just like, okay,
I'm just going to let the comparison between Man in the Mirror and any Katy Perry song, I'm going to let that go.
But you can let that go. You're aware of the statistic that she and MJ are the only two people to have 5 number ones off of a single album.
And
I'm just going to put that out
there. Let's just say that's not going to happen with Witness.
I just also
it's not going to happen with Witness.
Also, I just like the statistics. I don't want to say that statistics lie. I understand that they are factual.
Teenage Dream is an amazing album.
Justin Bieber is in the top 3 songs of Billboard Hot 100 right now. I don't want to hear anything about Justin Bieber or Michael Jackson. And I like Justin Bieber. But I'm just saying, like, numbers are funny.
Okay, but the spirit of Man in the Mirror, which is to distill the desire for global change down to personal change, is really where she's at now.
Is that bar in your piece? It should be in your piece.
Not exactly.
Okay.
A version.
Okay, good. As long as a version.
It's a long story, everyone.
It's a long, hashtag long read.
Yeah.
What are some things that you took away from spending time with Katy? That obviously, one thing that I took away from talking to you about spending time with Katy is she talks a lot.
She does.
You have this line in your piece that you very neatly distill the whole thing down, which is she speaks of the importance of dialogue, but speaks mostly in monologue. Which is like, that's a bar. That's a bar.
That's the effect of transcribing an interview yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
We did talk about this before I started transcribing. Everybody said, don't transcribe this yourself. And I said, no, I always do that. It's part of my process.
No Trent, kids.
Well,
no kid. No
it took
Trent.
A very long time because she spoke extremely densely and sometimes circuitously about similar topics. Sometimes she was doing the politician thing where you ask her a question and she answers a completely different question. And, you know, when you're sitting there with a very famous person, you're kind of smiling and nodding by, you know, default. And
she had some points she wanted to hit.
She had points she wanted to hit, and she definitely hit them, and she hit many of them repeatedly.
Yeah.
But, yes, it was very much a monologue. There were times where I was like, oh, hey, you know, there's something interesting I'd like to say about this. And she kind of was like, smile and continue on her point. Maybe something she picked up from hanging out with Hillary Clinton. I don't know. I admire it, to be honest. No. I mean, like, you know, it didn't help me with the writing of the piece. But she was also very intense. Like, I wrote about, I met her, like, after being around her a bit, we met for the first time at SNL, and she asked me so many pointed questions about what it was like to work here and who was going to be editing my story. And
what
how
is
many...
it like to work here?
Oh, no comment.
Yeah.
She seemed to indicate that she was a Times reader.
She is a Times reader.
Yeah. Home subscriber?
I don't know what
or
her,
just digital only.
I'll take digital only.
I'll take digital only, to be
for
fair.
For the record, I believe she is a full subscriber.
Full print subscriber.
Yeah.
Shouts to you, Katy Perry.
She really does want to be informed, and she is trying to take in as much information as possible, which
can
I think—
Can we pull up subscription data? Are we allowed to do that?
I don't think we're allowed
to do
like
that. Is that like cops pulling up like criminal records of people they're not supposed to? Okay, no, we won't
We're
do
not
it.
Going to do that,
We're not going to dox your subscriber data.
We're not going to do that. She's a very intense person to be around. You know, she's on.
So given that she frames this album in terms of transformation, but it's unclear that she was ever not transformed. I guess the thing that I'm sort of wrestling with on Witness is I didn't sense any internal struggle previously. And I'm not sensing internal struggle now. I'm sensing some kind of, it's like an answer record, but I don't know what it's an answer to.
I have a couple of ideas about that.
Yeah,
I mean, I think one thing is that, like, 4 years is a long time between these albums and that, like, a lot changed for her in her life.
Especially because she was really on that 18-month cycle, which pop stars mostly stick to in the beginnings of their career.
Yeah.
Yes.
Especially when they're hot.
Totally. I think that's point one. No, totally true.
Wow. Subtweet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
We just subtweeted literally. Oh, I'm sorry.
Actually.
John's hugging.
We don't know what you
John's
mean at all.
A cardboard cutout of Taylor Swift.
Who also used to be on the album cycle.
Damn,
you know, sometimes you get big enough to wait.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, okay. I think that's one fair point. I think another one is
you
that.
You can get Bon Iver big, yes. You know?
I would say also that she was working very closely with Dr. Luke, and while she maintained that she had a lot of artistic control in that relationship, and I don't doubt her, Dr. Luke is notorious for being an extremely controlling person to work with, and he has a lot of ideas about what your songs are going to sound like, when they're going to come out, what their titles are going to be, what you're going to wear when you're singing them. And I think that she might not have been able to express these things during that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I think also people told her that she was wrong. She referenced something she said at a Billboard speech. I'm not sure what the event was, where someone asked if she was a feminist, and she said no. She said that a friend tapped her, took her aside after that, and said, you know, this is what being a feminist means. I think you are one. And she was like, oh, my God, I'm mistaken. I am a feminist. I think she did a lot of intellectual and spiritual learning during these 4 years. So I don't think that the struggle was public, but I do think it was real.
So let's talk a little bit about how we let our pop stars change in public. Because I feel like a conversation that often happens around people who make radical aesthetic changes is it presumes one of those things was true and the other thing is not true. And sometimes you're moving from truth to inauthenticity, and sometimes you're moving from inauthenticity to truth. And I think this especially holds true for female singers. Why is it that historically there is less tolerance for that? With Katy, I feel like it can be a challenge because it was never clear what she was standing. To me, the difference is not between you stood for one thing and now you're standing for another thing, and I don't believe that you've traded A for B. It's more that I'm not sure what was there previously, and now there's all this stuff that's being unearthed, and that feels maybe not totally coherent. But I do think this is part of a larger problem in pop and how we allow people to grow or don't.
No, I totally agree. That's is a whole other section of the piece that I wish I could have written, but it would have been another 1,000 words. I think she saw herself as an entertainer that brought people pleasure. You know, we spoke about the Super Bowl performance, and I was like, yeah, you really just, like, killed it, and you brought out all of the hits that people really wanted to hear. And she's like, yeah, I'm aware of that. I knew that, like, this is what people wanted to hear and how it was going to make them feel, and it would be uplifting to do Roar and Firework and those things. So I think her move was just from being a pure entertainer to being a pure entertainer who would like you to think. But I also think she... Because she didn't start, like, we didn't become acquainted with her as a teen. She didn't have to go through the Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, I'm not a girl, not yet a woman moment where it was like, now I'm going to be sexual. Like, she kind of was, as you said, like, sexual out of the box. And now people are like, well, we just kind of liked looking at you, and now you're trying to tell us that you've got something to say. I mean, that seems like a sexism problem.
And you mentioned Madonna in your piece, that she's sort of the one who set the template for, you know, you can only be the same character for maybe two albums, mm-hmm. and then you have to reinvent. And I think for as many times as it's worked for Madonna, she's also caught a lot of flack for it, especially in the later part of her career, where it seemed like she was piggybacking on hot sounds or collaborators or whatever it was.
Also, I mean, a thing I found myself sympathetic with her in your piece, because I feel like, look, I don't pretend to know the inner workings of Katy Perry's mind circa 2017 or circa 2010, for that matter. We just have no way of knowing. I haven't interviewed her. I didn't interview her back then. But as a person who aspires to grow as a human being, and no one asks about it, but it's a thing. It's an ongoing process.
John, you want to talk about your growth?
Sure.
The therapist.
Special, sure. Yeah. Special podcast exclusive bonus edition. You know, but it's not something that the average person is forced to or even allowed the opportunity to discuss externally. Assuming these are genuine gestures on her part, I think she also, I would assume, knows that there's some part of her listenership and fan base, and those are not necessarily the same thing, that thinks that doing that is corny. Did you vibe that from her? Speaking openly about this stuff, about engaging with it and underscoring, hey, here's where I screwed up, and here's what I learned, and here's how I'm a better or at least more evolved person today than I was, you know, 5 years ago. Does she understand that there is some percentage of people who think,
I think she does understand that. I mean, I think she thought that there would be some resistance to this. Mm. This is part of the conversation was about, you know, are you willing to admit that you're going to be sacrificing some chart or sales success?
Yes.
Is that the price that you're going to pay for your personal growth and making the album that you really wanted to make? And, you know, her answer to that seemed to be, yes, I'm aware of that and I'm fine with it. Teenage Dream was kind of brutal. I don't want to do that again. I've already broken the records and sold all the albums. Now, do I think that she wants to be unsuccessful? You know, absolutely not. I think that she's still a business person and, you know, ambitious.
And used to winning.
Yeah.
I think.
But that's another thing that I think we should talk about was, like, you know, the idea in the world is that this is not successful. And this idea that this album is not successful existed weeks and months before the album did.
Oh, yeah.
That
of course.
The narrative was sculpted very early that this was going to be some sort of failure.
But to be fair, I mean, the early singles were, I think, among the less impressive songs on the record, just as standalone songs.
I will disagree. I think that all three are good singles. And there's like a couple of others that I would hear as potential singles. I don't hear a smash the way that you listen to Roar and you're like, oh boy.
No, there's none of that. But I feel like the Migos record is not the wave. Can we listen to a song that maybe is kind of a wave?
Yeah, what do you like?
Let's listen to Tsunami, what should be a Katy Perry single. Free A&R consultation. Okay, give us a second. We will be back right after this. A thing that is happening on this record in a bunch of different places is there's this pretty refined kind of modern disco idea that are on like three or four songs, especially title track Power maybe is another one. This as a beat, this, and Karen, you just looked up who produced it. Share with the world who produced that beat.
Mike Will made it.
And here's an interesting thing. Like, you think about what Mike Will did with Miley, and there was something a little overdetermined about it. I don't think it was unsuccessful, but it was overdetermined. It's very much like I'm yanking this person into my space. This beat feels like a genuine compromise between, like, here are the textures and patterns that Mike Will excels at, and here's the universe that Katy Perry songs probably need to live in. And those are not the same place.
Well, I think that's a testament to Mike Will's development over the last 5 years.
Absolutely. I don't personally think Katy is, like, quite nimble enough a vocalist to do, like, that's not my favorite vocal of hers on this record, but it is one of the more original sounding songs on even the good songs on this record. I feel like don't sound totally original. This is one of the more original sounding songs.
We can give credit to the sort of sonic palette of it, which is it's not really chasing trends. It has a little, as you say, like disco. There's like moments of 80s, but it's, you know, she's working here with Hot Chip, with Purity Ring, with this guy, Jack Garrett, who she has been shouting out for years. She corralled at least an interesting group of not necessarily what you would imagine Katy Perry would be doing in 2017.
Is there any Max Martin on this record?
Yes. There's
quite a bit of Max
Martin.
There's
a couple, and he executive produced.
But I think that the where you can give this album credit, you know, apart from some of the cringeworthy lyrics, which really take me out of it, is that it is pretty cohesive in sound. And I think that goes back a little bit to the point you were making, John, about authenticity. And I think in the last, especially 5 years of pop, and this idea has been swirling a little in the reviews of this, but it seems to be Katy's first time where she wanted to make an album, a capital A album. She was always a singles artist.
Yes.
And Teenage Dream was a good album because it had 5 number one singles on it. It wasn't a good album because it told you a story front to back. But, you know, when we've seen Kanye West and Beyonce and Rihanna pretty much say, you know, we've had our number one singles, we don't need to do that anymore, here's a body of work, and been so successful at it with Lemonade and Anti.
What if you have both, though?
and some people have both. But right, I think,
but I also say that they were challenged less when they presented that idea.
Yes, of course. And Katy Perry, I think, was so much a singles artist in that people literally only listened to her singles, or, you know, I would say a casual fan only knew Katy Perry's singles.
And there
so
were a
it's
lot
harder
of
to
casual
buy.
Fans. Right. It's very easy to be a casual fan of Katy Perry because her songs are ubiquitous and often decontextualized from the albums. So it is actually rather easy to be kind of like, Katy Perry, she does that song. And so the reframing maybe takes like a little bit more of a leap.
I think it's true. But, you know, I think of her in League with Rihanna, where I enjoy Rihanna albums, but she seemed like a singles artist. And then Anti really is an album. And I think that a lot of people rejected that idea for a long time. Speaking for myself, I rejected that idea for a long time. It took me like a year to come around to the idea that Anti was actually a really smart album.
We all need to re-review Anti.
We do, but also very similarly, like it seemed like it had the most messy, troubled rollout of any album I had ever seen. And then you look at Witness and like that was a pretty messy rollout too.
Although on the plus side, no phone company was involved.
Yes.
At least none that I know of.
No, it didn't have as many corporate, you know, uncomfortable tie-ins. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they had a lot of false starts. You know, I don't know if you remember them all. I could probably mention a few, but like, you know, there were giant disco balls in certain cities and you could go hear Chain to the Rhythm. She delivered cherry pies in Times Square to talk about Bon Appetit.
I mean, there's a forgotten first single even going further back.
We're talking about Rise?
Rise.
That was an Olympic anthem.
Which maybe was going to be the beginning of a Katy Perry album cycle that never happened.
And just one final insult is our friend to my right, Taylor, why did you drop all your records on all streaming services the night that Katy Perry's Witness was released?
We'll take that as a no comment.
I mean,
you're among friends. Like, you could just tell us. Like, we promise. Like, we won't really make a big deal of it. Talk to us.
It will be very interesting to see how history treats that decision over the next year.
So an interesting thing has been happening in the last 2 or 3 years, which is you have what feels to me like female pop counter narratives, where you have singers who are, I don't want to say they're outsiders, even though they're presented as such, but I think starting with Lorde and running through Lana and running through an Alessia Cara, even some of Selena's stuff, you have essentially these alternative presentations of female pop stars. And we've always had, I mean, you know, Madonna had dark periods. I mean, it's not totally novel, but in an era of Katy Perry gleam and an era of Taylor Swift gleam, the fact that there is an entire room basically reserved now for female singers who are offering gloomier narratives, who are working with less conventional pop formats, is striking. With the Lorde record and the Halsey record a couple weeks ago, we seem to be, I don't want to say in the peak moment of that because I feel like it's been happening for a couple of years, but those singers are very popular. Alessia Cara has a very big record with Zedd right now. Selena and Kygo, a very big record right now. Halsey
She's working on it.
She's trying. Doing her best. And Lord is back.
Oh God, I'm clean out of air in my lungs. It's all gone. Played it so nonchalant. It's time we dance with the truth. Move along with the truth. Ooh. Hey, we're sleeping through all the days. I'm acting like I don't see every weapon you used to tie yourself to me. But my hips have missed your hips, so let's get to know the kicks. Will you sway with me? Go astray with me.
That is Sober off the new Lord album, Melodrama. Also, Melodrama. It's her second album, first in 4 years. And Lord, I think, became sort of an inadvertent figurehead for a lot of younger singers with the success of Pure Heroin. Well, she really likes double entendre titles.
I mean, and they're both good.
Both good, but I guess I had to say them both to really be like, aw, aw.
We see what you did there, Laura.
I enjoyed the look of awareness that flickered across your face.
Just a click,
face.
Reminds me of your get information moment.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
I
don't have an iPad. I don't have an iPad to throw. So anyway, she's got two versions, like Frank.
Yes.
And the big hit isn't the single, also like Frank. Melodrama is, I think, much better than Pure Heroin. A thing that's, when we're going to talk a little bit about Halsey in a bit, but when I was thinking about Lord in a Katy Perry context, I don't think they occupy the same space at all, but I was trying to understand what actually differentiated them. And obviously, lyrical quality and tone and manner. But let's talk about vocal presence. A thing that in listening to Witness that I kept being reminded of is Katy is so malleable. She's so adaptable. And you could take that either as a compliment or an insult. She's good on a disco song. She's good on a pop rock song. She's good on.
Take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
On her behalf.
Yes. This side of the room can do that.
Yeah.
But she's so malleable. Lord has the exact opposite problem. Her voice is so specific. And on the first album, I don't want to say they stumbled into a style, but they developed a style that suited the particular texture and weird corners of her voice. What they've succeeded on this album is actually finding an entirely different sound.
That still works with the voice.
That's suited to that. And that, I think, is a real high bar. And I was very, very struck by it when I was listening to it, how clever a lot of the musical decisions were.
Well, I would say that there's a third way that her voice is perfect. Do you remember what we call the disclosure song Magnets
from
the
last album?
That's my favorite Lord appearance. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish she would
in
that direction.
That's a fire take.
Good take.
Never really felt bad about it. As we drank deep from the light, 'cause I felt melting magnets, babe. The second I saw you through half shut eyes, smoke and sunset off Mulholland. He was talking, I was wondering about you and that girl. She your girlfriend, face from heaven. Bet the world she don't know. Pretty girls don't know things that I know. Walk my way, I'll share the things that you won't. Oh, dancing past the point of no
pain. On Melodrama, I think similar to Pure Heroin, and this sort of goes back to this idea of singles pop star versus album pop star, is she worked basically with a very small group of collaborators, much larger on this, her follow-up, than on Pure Heroin. But mostly we're hearing Jack Antonoff on Melodrama. You get a little bit of Malay in there, who's worked with Frank Ocean. Mm-hmm. Frank Dukes stops by to do a little drums.
Frank Dukes
and
getting his money.
He's around.
Shouts to Frank Dukes.
But Lord, I think, is a pop auteur more than most of the
anyone
people that she can be compared to.
Yes,
she produces, she writes. writes. She and similarly to Halsey and to Alessia and, you know, Bebe Borelli and I recently saw Jesse Reyes, who I think also fits in this world. They come from bedrooms more than they come from like
studios,
boardrooms.
Boardrooms.
And
I think like, you know, Lord was signed to a label at age 13, but she was gestating for a very long time, and she sort of took it upon herself in a same way we've seen Frank Ocean do, you know, where he's sort of on the shelf and then he creates this sort of style.
All of which makes me want to say that let Matt Ox cook.
Give Matt Ox a Pro Tools rig in his bedroom.
Just like give him,
and let
give
it
him
happen.
3 years. Just let it happen, okay? Whoever's out there, all my friends at labels, let Matt Ox cook.
But I think that that's a new phenomenon that we could get, especially for young women, where they've taken control of the means of production quite literally, and they can sit in their room and make a song like Royals, which is good enough to be on every radio station in the universe.
The thing that I found admirable about what's happening on this record is all these resources are available to her now. If she wanted to make a full committee record, all your favorite songwriters, all your favorite producers, top, middles, bottoms, vocal coaches, vocal producers, the whole thing, all available.
Although Coo Carell, our favorite vocal producer, does show up on the Lord album on
shouts,
a few songs.
Shouts to my guy. I actually think that part of the Despacito problem, I don't know if Coo was working with Justin. I feel like Justin would have been further stuck in his head.
Sidebar.
Yeah, just, you know, throwing that out there.
For the real heads.
Yes, so you know. So
you were saying all of those tools are available.
Yes, they're all available, and the restraint is really admirable. Now, who knows? There might be B-sides and deep cuts and Pro Tool sessions that reflect having gone through that process. But the idea that she didn't release any of that or just chose to distill down before this point, I found very admirable.
And I think maybe one of the reasons why she connected so much with Jack Antonoff, who I recently did a story about he's a producer and a songwriter and has his own bands, is he records at home. He's literally, a lot of this album was written and recorded in Brooklyn Heights in his apartment, in his studio. And I think that he and Lord come from similar places with that. Now, Halsey, on the other hand...
You just really want to just drag this to Halsey.
because I think it really does tie together.
Okay, we're going to come back to Lord. Let's talk about
Halsey.
I just want to
make one point about Halsey.
Yes. Oh, I got points.
I want Joe to talk about Halsey.
Is that, you know, I wrote a piece about Halsey before her first album came out, and what I was initially...
Pre-memes,
pre-Chainsmokers.
Is that a humble brag?
It's just a fact, isn't it?
It's not humble at all, actually.
But I think what was initially compelling to me about her is that she had a similar backstory, which is that she's making these songs by herself in her room before any label was even noticing, and she developed a sound. Now, her first album comes out. It's a pretty modest success. You know, she's a huge live act. She has a very loyal fan base. Then she gets this hit with the Chainsmokers, and again, all those tools become available to her, and I think what you see on the Halsey album, Hopeless Fountain Kingdom, is the flip side of the Lord coin, which is
that
she used all of those tools, and it sort of loses her essence.
And Halsey's an interesting midpoint, I think, actually, between Lord and Katy Perry, because what you're saying about Halsey using all those tools is real. So she's Lord's mood with Katy Perry's arsenal.
Right.
Totally.
And unfortunately, Katy Perry's lack of vocal tone. And this is something that I struggled with a lot on Closer, which is the Chainsmokers record that she got really big on. And let's listen to, like, I don't know, 3 seconds.
I can just sing it for you.
No,
okay,
no, please.
We'll listen.
I'm trying to help you. let's listen to 3 seconds of Closer.
Look as good as the day I met you. I forget just why I left you. I was insane. Stay and play that Blink 182 song. That we beat to death in Tucson. Okay.
How am I supposed to get my label deal if you don't let me sing on my podcast, John?
Fine, Karen. So a thing that happened on Closer is it was the first time that I listened to Halsey, and I don't love the first Halsey record by any stretch, but I felt like it was identifiably Halsey. And Closer was the first time where I was like, she can be smoothed out. She can be defeated, in essence. All of that history doesn't matter. If all people know you from is this one Chainsmokers record, you could take that L. And then that could be your life. And I remember when the first single from this record came out.
Now or Never.
Now or Never, which I like, but it doesn't sound like Halsey.
Because it's a Stara record, and Stara is, you know, one of the top songwriters in the game right now, and they put her in a room with Halsey, and that's what comes out.
And I really struggle with this, because I remember even when I wrote about that song, I think in Playlist, on our Friday Playlist, I was really concerned. I was like, oh, you really did, you let the Chainsmokers thing affect you. It got in your head. And I don't know if it got in her head that you want to be super successful, and part of the way you do that is by letting go of control, or part of the way you do that is by sandpapering down what you do and letting other people do what they do. Unclear what the sort of mechanism is, but that was the first indication, I think, that this record was going to be less Halsey-ish.
And having spent a lot of time with Halsey, and, you know, she's a very intense person, and she is all about control, and I think, you know, she would be deeply wounded to feel like she gave up control. But I think where she tried to maintain it on this album is this idea of a concept record and directing the videos and sort of art directing the whole thing.
And like Romeo and Juliet quotes.
Yeah, but I think, there's a Baz Luhrmann thing. Yeah. But I think if the songs aren't there, all of that
is for naught.
Is for naught. And I think, to bring this back to Lorde, a more successful concept album where she keeps control is Melodrama.
Yeah, and I don't want to, like, overly malign the Halsey record, because there are a couple moments. Should we listen to Strangers?
I think Strangers is one Strangers of the best songs of the summer.
I think it should be a top 10 record.
I think it will be.
You think so?
I think they'll push it? If they play it right, I think it will be.
All right, well, here's hoping. Strangers featuring Lauren Jauregui of Fifth Harmony. Total Jauregui Hive.
Jauregui Hive
all day. So that's Strangers from the Halsey record.
Karen's shaking her head.
She's vibrating.
I don't dislike the song. I like the song. I think it's a good song. But the way the song is being billed is like one of the first lesbian songs. Right. It's just absurd. I mean, has anyone heard of the many, 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 many albums of music that Tegan and Sarah have made?
Damn, son.
It's true. And tell them why you're mad, Karen. They have a song called Boyfriend that was a single on the last record, which literally says, like, you treat me like I'm your boyfriend. But they're singing about a woman, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I like the song. I hope it's successful. But this narrative is like, quite flawed.
Do you think the narrative is emanating from the Halsey camp? Or you think it's just, like, sort of
short-sighted? No, I think it's just out there because people just don't know.
I think the points they're getting are for a duet. Where it's a same-sex duet, but again, you know, it's a little icky.
Semantics, yeah.
The song's good.
The song is good. The song's great.
The song is good, and I think, look, with Halsey, I do think part of the sales pitch is boundary pushing, edge blurring, yada yada. And so I think if there was a same-sex erotic duet that ends up being a top 10 Billboard record, that actually goes, in my mind, a long way to kind of erasing Closer. Because Closer, I think, is such an anvil hanging around your neck.
And I think if you were to ask Halsey, she would love to erase Closer. And I think if you're interested enough to get a little peek into her head right now, I think the best place to do that is friend of the podcast Phoebe Riley wrote a story about Halsey for Vulture, which I think does a good job of this weird tightrope walk between, you know, alternative bedroom pop and major star that's going on here.
It also is a reminder that for all this conversation that we have, that Katy Perry, you know, there's the executive from Capitol, Karen, in your story.
Yeah, the chairman and CEO.
Chairman, who's just like, yeah, you know, Katie, we give her all the resources. She's earned the right. Lord, obviously, has earned the right to do this. Halsey, maybe, has not quite totally earned that right.
I would say Katie is the only one of these three that's earned the right, to be honest. She's been in the game for a long time.
Damn!
She paid her dues.
Yo, I'm going to add Lord to that list. I'm just going to add.
Okay, I'll let you complete your thought, but that is.
I was just saying, for all this conversation about it, agency is not easy to come by.
Especially for women in the music
industry. Yes. And also,
even though women are the only ones on the pop charts.
Yes. And there are
and
also,
Justin Bieber.
Yes, that's it though.
And yeah. There are also plenty of ways to have your agency compromised that are not overt. And I think what I see in the Halsey record are these kind of subcutaneous diminishments.
They're compromises.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I don't know if they're presented. I think there's many ways to make someone you work with compromise. There's going up front and saying you need to do this, or there's 1,000 paper cuts. And then at the end, the person sort of like softens. Well,
Lord
and
Halsey are both in their early 20s, and Katie's 32 and has, you know, all the statistics that we mentioned earlier to stand on. I think that she's earned a lot, you know, of latitude from her record, from her label.
Well, Taylor, how old are you? You're really just not talking today. Okay. That seemed like a pretty non-confrontational question.
It'll
okay.
be interesting to me to see the commercial performance of this Lord album. I think Royals was such a supernova. It was such a weird song to be as big as it was.
And I don't think there's not a Royals on this record, but that's okay.
Yeah, and I think this isn't going to have the smashes. I think, you know, she's going to do well because she's a great artist, but she's not going to be on the radio like she was last time around.
But can we talk? Okay, let's talk a little bit about this, because actually my favorite part of the rollout of the Lord record is the Max Martin conversation.
Yes.
And where was this conversation
in
documented?
In the New York Times Magazine.
In the Times Magazine story.
Which maybe we've mentioned it on the podcast before.
So Lord goes to play
Greenlight.
Specifically Greenlight. Yeah, that wasn't the whole album.
I believe it was Greenlight.
Specifically Greenlight, which is the first single, which is not my favorite song on this record. But
it's, love this song.
A lot of people really love it. Not trying to knock it. It just doesn't do a lot for me. But takes Greenlight to Max Martin and plays it. And Max Martin is basically like, the math is wrong. Yep. Like, cool, but the math is wrong. And what I love is that's the net. Like, that's actually exactly what Max Martin should say. That's like someone putting a negative review from a critic you don't trust on, like, the spine of your book.
You know what I mean? It works.
Yeah.
It's it gives everybody what they want.
And no one is compromised. Max Martin is like, yo, I'm really about this Max Martin life. Lord is like, cool, and I'm not about that Max Martin life. I'm about this Lord life. And everybody who's on Lord's team is like, whatever, later for them. Everybody wins. And so that little
except
piece
Greenlight on the pop charts.
Oh, I didn't say Max Martin was wrong.
Well, that's what kind of freaks me out.
I do agree with Max.
Because
is wrong.
When we heard that song, I thought that song was going to be a smash. I was like, this is it. This is such a great song. It's anthemic. It's like, you know, recovering from a breakup song. It delivers everything. The math is bad. I don't get it, though.
I wish Max Martin would have corrected some of Katy Perry's math on some of those verses.
Speaking of, true stuff.
Show your work, Joe.
But a thing that I find really appealing about this and admirable about this Lord album is how much of the math is wrong and yet how consistently strong it is in spite of wrong math.
Sober, which we played a little earlier, is like it seems like it's going to have a huge chorus and then it sort of undercuts itself, but it has these horn stabs that are amazing.
All right, let's just play the loop. Right. That's the jam.
Broadcast the boom, boom. Thing progresses, I call and you come through. Blow all my friendships to sit in hell with you. But we're the greatest, they'll hang us in the Louvre. Down the back, but who cares, still the Louvre. Okay, I know that you are not my type, still I fall. I'm just a sucker, let you fill her mind. But what about love? Nothing wrong with it, supernatural.
Violence. Make a phone. make them all dance to it.
So that's the Louvre, which is some, a wild jam.
Some Jack Antonoff special sauce in the background on that one.
Okay, so this album, you know, she has presented as a fair and true document of what the last couple of years of her life have been like. And an interesting thing about Lorde is, you know, Lorde got famous when she was 16 or 17. We don't think of her as a teen pop star, but she was young. This is very much the I'm not young anymore album. And I think that may not, other people may not focus on that, but so many of the lyrics on this record are about various kinds of awakenings, various kinds of disappointments. This is something that actually you won't see from a Katy Perry. You won't see even from a Halsey. I think Lorde is at a very specific moment in her life that no other singer in this category of singers mm-hmm. is at, and therefore is not detailing it.
She's also confessional in a way that they aren't. She's a diary writer. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
The closest recent record that I can think of that is presented from a similar place is by my group, Hey Violet, which we should all listen to the Hey Violet record because there is a lot of transitional life lyrics on that record as well.
I thought we were going to go to like a Tori Amos place or something.
I mean, there's some of that too.
I was preparing.
I think there's shades of it in the Paramore album, in moving in that direction.
Although the Paramore album ultimately feels like more of an aesthetic tweak than a life. I mean, I think you can point to Misery Business or whatever and be like, it's in there too. Maybe the only equivalent, and this would be in a Funhouse Mirror equivalent, would be what Miley is doing right now. Should we play Malibu or Inspired?
Both. I think we should save this for another podcast.
Okay, we'll do another one, but let's listen to just a moment of whatever it is that Lorde is taking on, Miley is taking off on Malibu.
I never came to the beach or stood by the ocean. I never sat by the shore under the sun with my feet in the sand, but you brought me here. And I'm happy that you did, 'cause now I'm as free as birds catching the wind. I always thought I would sing, so I never swam. I never went boating, don't get how they are floating. And sometimes I get so scared of what I can't understand. But here I am.
That happened. That happened.
I know I reviewed a Miley show last year and it was a little bit too much for me. I guess it was almost 2 years ago now.
Dead pets. But this is not
quite enough.
Miley, no pets.
I feel like you guys are a little out on this. I'm gonna go ahead and say I think Miley transitioning from, you know, wagging around dildos to being basic chic is a wave. Subversive.
The hottest take. You think it's subversive?
And I think it's hilarious.
And I think she's
in on the joke.
I don't doubt it, but what do you think the real joke is? That she's doing that or that Katy Perry is taking on Miley Cyrus circa 2014 and saying, actually, this is what I as a grown-up.
I'm just here for all the musical chairs. I'll put it that way.
All right. Well, then let's bring this long game of musical chairs to a conclusion. One thing that I also took away from the Lorde record, and we're going to close on a Lorde song because I feel like the most strongly about that album of the three that we've discussed. I feel like Lorde reads the internet.
Oh, she reads the internet.
Are you aware of her?
She may or may not be a secret Onion Ring critic. Did you see that blog post, John?
No.
You're in for a treat after this podcast.
Okay, great.
We'll link to that.
So, because there are two songs back to back on this record. One is called Writer in the Dark, which obviously everybody knows, don't date a writer. Like, please don't do that. And then followed by Supercut.
Shouts to Rich. Shouts
to Rich. Shouts to Rich. Like, immediate first thing I thought, shouts to Rich.
King of the Supercut.
Yeah. So let's go out on Supercut, which is, I think, maybe not going to be the biggest song on this record.
But it's a jam.
It's great. It's a super, 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 super powerful song.
Come home tonight.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast on Lorde and Katy Perry and Halsey and the many micro movements of contemporary female pop. Thank you to my guests, Karen Gans and Joe Coscarelli. You can listen to every podcast ever, and you really should. There's a lot of bangers at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us. Email me your ranking of these three records. I'm actually curious. I'd like to know where people put these three records in order, Halsey, Lorde, and Katy. Email that to us at podcast@nytimes.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is the loyal Pedro Rosado, and we are back next week.